This is a true crime and real-time update from the On Deadline podcast. We explore crime stories covered by Odyssey's radio newsrooms from coast to coast. I'm your host, Lauren Berry. This week, we'll hear about a family annihilator case that has shocked communities in Western New York, with a focus on how such cases can impact the mental health of investigators who work on them. We'll also take a deep look into the Carmelo Anthony case in Texas. 18-year-old Anthony is accused of stabbing 17-year-old Austin Metcalf to death last year at a Frisco track meet. Anthony's trial began this week, and it's already causing controversy. A June 1st crime spree in Western New York has left local communities reeling this week, according to Odyssey station WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo.
A Cheektowaga man has been charged with killing his wife, two young children, and a store clerk in Buffalo.
Saleh Muhammad arraigned on four counts of murder in the second degree, one count of murder in the first degree. Erie County District Attorney Mike Kane detailed what happened Monday.
About 3:30 in the afternoon, the Cheektowaga police officers responded to a scene at a home on Ellen Drive. The police found three victims, the defendant's wife and his two children, a 26-year-old woman and her two sons, a 4-year-old and a 3-year-old, both little boys. They had both been shot to death. A little bit earlier, about 2:30 or 2:40 in the afternoon, the Buffalo Police Department, Buffalo police officers responded to a store on Grant Street near Military for a reported shooting. They entered the store and a store clerk, a 43-year-old man, was found. He was shot and he died at the scene. He was also shot to death by the defendant. I will note that if the defendant is convicted of the highest count of these charges, murder in the first degree, he will face a maximum sentence of life in prison without parole.
Buffalo Police Chief of Detectives Joe Reardon on responding to the scene.
It's never a good scene to have to walk into with human life dead right in front of you right there, and especially when it's children, and it affects the investigators and stuff like that. So everybody's working together as a team, getting things done, and I just appreciate all the help we received.
What must have been a horrible scene?
I could imagine. Thank God I didn't have to go into myself, but I could imagine.
The murders rocking two Western New York neighborhoods. WBEN's Brayton Wilson brings us more.
North District Councilman Joe Golombek says Monday's fatal shooting of a store clerk along Grant Street rattled a number of his constituents in the Black Rock neighborhood, but believes there is a sense of relief knowing that it was a targeted shooting rather than a random act of violence.
It wasn't like, you know, you were walking down the street and you could have been shot. This was, it looks like, somebody going after somebody in particular. So there's a little bit of a relief in that regard. But once again, it's just tragic.
One customer who patroned the store often was Chris from Kenmore, who's among those still in shock upon hearing of Monday's fatal shooting.
I go to that store every day, and he was the nicest man you would ever meet in your life. This guy would go out of his way. He'll give you the shirt off his back. And why does it got to happen to people like that? Why has it got to happen at all? I'm stunned by it. I am absolutely stunned and feel so bad for the family. That store is open no matter what. Blizzards, they never close. And this just stinks.
Buffalo Mayor Sean Ryan says the recent crimes happening across different parts of the city have been a bit different, especially with the weather now warming up. He notes that Buffalo Police, led by new Commissioner Erica Shields, continues to work closely with the community to build stronger relationships in an effort to get a handle on what's happening.
Crime and acts of crime are all moving targets. Sometimes you fall into patterns with that, and we've done a good job of interrupting the pattern crimes. But what we've been seeing in the last 6 weeks is something different, and that is just a series of crimes unrelated to any other crimes.
Former Buffalo Police Commissioner Joe Grimalia joined a new morning out of WBEN Wednesday to discuss the case and how law enforcement officials are impacted when they witness horrific crime scenes.
I mean, Joe, you may be out of the department, but you are always a police officer. What are your thoughts this morning about this horrific crime?
Good morning. It's obviously it's horrible. Any loss of life, anytime you have a homicide, loss of life, it's horrible. But it hits you particularly hard when you're talking about very young children. It's you know, it's a horrible situation, and it's also, you know, very traumatic for the officers who enter that home and have to see that you know, that type of situation.
Yeah, I can't imagine. You mentioned traumatic. What is available for officers to, you know, be able to deal with walking into a scene like that?
You know, fortunately, there's more resources now than there ever has been in police departments for, you know, throughout my career. For far too long, it was, you know, you just kind of dealt with it. You didn't talk about it. You know, you just kind of suck it up, or, you know, go talk to the guys after work and you know, have a beer or something. It's, you know, that's not the case anymore, and that shouldn't be the case. Back in May of 2023, we appointed our first ever wellness officer within the department, whose sole purpose was to look out for the welfare of the officers. And it, you know, fortunately, the way it works now is any type of loss of life, calls of children, traumatic incidents, or that wellness officer is proactively reaching out to the officers and saying, hey, look, we're here. There's resources available. And, you know, the officers really bought into that. And it's not just within our department. You know, other agencies have this, and they work together. They reach out to one another, and they want to make sure that they're helping each other out.
You know, we had John Elmore on the air yesterday, who is an attorney locally. He's also a former state trooper. And he said, you know, in a scene like this, it never leaves an officer's brain. You have to go to work the next day, and everybody just takes it for granted that the officers are okay. Are officers reluctant to take any of this, you know, mental health screening that you're talking about, or are they open and willing to accept it?
You know, you started out by saying that, you know, the officers have to go back to work, and it's, you know, sometimes they're going right back to the next call. It's not even the next day. And I remember the first infant death, you know, that I had doing CPR on a 6-week-old baby on the way to Children's Hospital. And I still think about that to this day. And that was the beginning of my career. But, you know, I think officers have been a lot more and open to, you know, to talking. You know, from what I heard from Matt Cross, the Buffalo Police Wellness Officer, that they certainly were getting a lot more buy-in. The Buffalo Police Department has a pretty robust peer team of all volunteer officers, again, whose sole focus is to help guide officers to the right, you know, the right direction, to the right spot, to try to get those resources. Their calls were definitely increasing, and I think this new generation of officers, you know, really buys into it and understands.
You know, one thing about not just what happened on Monday, but if you look back to last week, what happened the previous week in the city of Buffalo. I mean, even going back to the top shooting, what happened there. These are horrific crimes that happen in the middle of the day, you know, around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I think, you know, people just kind of think that this kind of stuff happens at night. Is it surprising to you when something like this would happen in broad daylight? And, you know, does it go to show just maybe the dangers that police officers face? It doesn't matter what time their shift is.
No, it doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, I think there's this misnomer that, oh, it's daytime. It's, you know, stuff doesn't happen until the sun goes down. And some of our biggest tragedies, and you just talked about, we had an officer stabbed, a week and a half ago. Last week, we had an officer shot. Thank God they survived those injuries. One's going to take, you know, longer to recover than the other one, I believe. Tops, as you mentioned, happened during the daytime. You know, things happen during days, the daytime shift. And, you know, thank God we also have, you know, excellent police officers that respond. You know, you're not going to prevent every crime from occurring. You know, there are a lot of things that the police officers do prevent. You have a gang shooting, you know there's going to be retaliatory crimes that come after that, and you can certainly plan for that, and you can prevent those further ones from occurring. Sometimes things are going to happen, and if you can't prevent it, it's how do you respond to it? And I think, you know, our department and, you know, our police officers have responded in kind and have stopped the threat very, very quickly. And, you know, again, just thank God those officers are going to, you know, survive those injuries, and they're going to be okay. But again, they got to get the resources, they got to get the help, and you know, they're very proactive. The departments are very proactive of reaching out to these officers as opposed to waiting for someone to spiral down and then try to, you know, pull them out from the bottom.
WBEN's Tom Burrell also discussed the case with a former police chief from the town where the tragedy played out.
The homicide situation from Monday is still rattling around in my brain, probably yours as well. And I want to bring aboard a gentleman whom I've known for quite some time, actually, and one of the few people in Western New York that I actually, I think I might be an inch taller than he is, but let's bring aboard Dave Zak, the former police chief of Cheektowaga, New York. When you heard the story and you heard Ellen Drive, what were some of the things that went through your mind, Chief?
I mean, you know, anytime anything in Cheektowaga, it's going to strike a nerve with me. So obviously, I know our department and I know the officers there, and I just know how capable they are.
You know, Cheektowaga does not have a lot of murders, not a lot of homicides, a few, but not a lot. Therefore, when a situation like this happens, where you have three dead bodies in a house on Ellen, in terms of processing the crime scene, which is hugely important in any prosecution, does the lack of experience with multiple victims influence at all your ability to properly process the scene of the crime?
No, I mean, it's really, you know, your level of training. These are the incidents that we prepare for. And especially in Cheektowaga, I think for decades now, going back well, you know, before myself as chief of police, training was always an emphasis. And I just think that everyone who's come before me, comes after me, that's still the case. So in a situation like that, your training just kicks in. And if you've been trained properly, you know what to do.
So do you know at this point, does Cheektowaga have anything like the Faro focused laser scanner, the Leica geosystem, or the Skybrows to preserve the scene? There's also the Oscar 360 to preserve the scene. This computer digital equipment that'll come in. It's like a camera, except it captures every bit of data, not just the images.
I mean, I'm not, you know, I got to be honest, I'm very close with the current Chief Coons. I'm not exactly sure the technology that currently exists with the department, but certainly, you know, if they don't have the tools currently, they know where to obtain them, and they know the people to bring in if it becomes necessary.
You're not sure about the equipment in terms of the procedure for safeguarding the scene so it can be properly documented. And, you know, the Guthrie case out in Arizona, the police were criticized heavily, and frankly, I think they maybe deserve some of it, not all of it, but some of it, because they didn't know they were dealing with a kidnapping at first. They thought it was just a missing person, so maybe a wanderer or something like that. But can you just walk through the scene, the process, the procedure of processing a crime scene? Because what we were told in Police Academy is that, number one, if you ever come into a situation like that, try to touch nothing. Just call the detectives and stay away. Call the detectives and get out. Watch. Make sure nobody's going in or out. Number one. Number two, you never get a second chance to process a crime scene the first time, which seems self-evident, but it really isn't. Please go ahead with that.
Yeah, I mean, those are the general rules. Every scene presents its own challenges as far as securing and protecting, and that's what you want to do. That's going to give you, you know, your best opportunity to a proper conclusion. So, you know, of course, that's paramount, and you know, that's going to have a lot to do with your success or failure. But every scene presents its own challenge. I've worked many, many crime scenes, and you know, securing a crime scene is not always the easiest thing to do. And it seems elementary, but, you know, there's an art to it. And, you know, if you go all the way back to the JonBenet Ramsey case, where there were problems with securing the scene, you know, you have outdoor scenes, you have indoor scenes, you have the elements to contend with. You have safety concerns when you first enter. So there's a lot that goes into it, and every scene is completely different.
Do you have any inside information, Dave, that you would not be stepping on toes by sharing as to whether or not the suspect made a confession when he was taken into custody by law enforcement. If you don't know, just say you don't know. If you know but you can't say, just say, I don't know.
I do not. I do not know. But what I can tell you is a scene like that, and I have personally been involved in several of those type scenes where I've had to enter, and you know, and I talked a little bit about training, but nothing prepares you for that, and it's extremely traumatic for, you know, the officers who responded, but then like to go in and then process, because processing is not, you know, sometimes it's hours, days, weeks in some cases. And when you're in there and you as you're working a scene like that, you can't help but think about the victims, but it's your thoughts and your desire to do those victims right, which is what drives you. And you're able to compartmentalize and do your job, and you understand that the victims can't speak, and now you have to speak for them. And when you're done and you walk away, and you know you did the best you could, and but days, weeks, sometimes years later, those memories come back to haunt you.
Yeah.
And I can speak to that from personal experience. There are child victims that I've dealt with. I ran sex offense for a long time. Mm. And I was, you know, one of the I led the crime scene investigation unit in Cheektowaga. So we dealt with a lot of that stuff. And you never forget those victims. And but you put your nose to the grindstone.
But it became less stressful to your entire existence the more you had to do that, the more calls you got called out on that were grisly?
I wouldn't say that, but, I had about four or five, which were, you know, pretty intense. And they were all hard. The first one was the most shocking. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as you know what you're going to be entering, you're able to kind of prepare yourself. And it's kind of like, you know, it's game time. And you got to be strong. You got to do the work. And you got to control your emotions. And you got to be a true professional, because these victims are counting on you right now.
Sure.
And you don't have the time to think about how it's affecting you. You just go in and do your thing and do what you need to do. And I know those officers in Cheektowaga. They did their thing. They did what they had to do. And they're going to deal with those memories. They're going to deal with that stress. And, you know, fortunately now we're much better at dealing with officer wellness. So I have no doubt that Chief Coons is going to take very good care of his people.
Now we're headed to Texas, where the trial for 18-year-old Carmelo Anthony began this week. Here's Odyssey Station KRLD 1080 with the details.
The jury is now seated in McKinney to hear the Carmelo Anthony murder trial, accused in last year's stabbing at a Frisco track meet.
And it's a murder trial attracting attention across the country.
This is the Carmelo Anthony trial, the teenager who admitted to stabbing to death Austin Metcalf at a Frisco High School track meet last year. Anthony claims it was in self-defense. There's been demonstrations around the courthouse this week, advocates for Anthony, others calling for justice for Metcalf. This case has attracted media from all across the country. Social media personalities.
Nikat Knight, I'm out of California. I am an independent commentator, media reporter.
And I live in Melissa, which is 5 minutes north of here. And I thought, well, let's go up there and just kind of do some stuff.
All the way up to Court TV, this is Cody Thomas.
It's one of those cases that grabs headlines immediately. Not just because of the sheer, you know, emotional, raw nature of it, but we have to be honest about the optics of it.
The jury's been selected. However, no black jurors on the panel. Some have expressed their disappointment over that. Russell Scott, News Radio 1080 KRLD.
KRLD also reached out to an expert to help unpack some of the unusual aspects of this case and to discuss why it's gained national attention.
We're joined by our criminal expert, Dr. Alex Del Carmen. He's a criminologist at Del Carmen Consulting. Doc, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
What is it about this case that has fascinated everybody?
First of all, I think that a lot of people can relate to the idea of having their kids, you know, be at a sport event locally. And then all of a sudden, you know, what seemed to be a very normal day with rain coming down and, you know, everybody getting along just fine. All of a sudden, you've got a murder and someone that brought a knife to the equation. And unfortunately, somebody's life changed permanently at that point.
You know, prosecutors showed news footage from that day. You brought up the rain. You know, they wanted the jury to know that, you know, it was raining that day. Everything started normal. Then all of a sudden, their expert witness points out from this news footage that something has occurred, something has changed. How do prosecutors kind of go through the day-to-day events so they can demonstrate to the jury the facts as the investigators understand them?
Well, what the prosecutor is going to do is try to make the case that this was not an individual that simply showed up with a knife at a school event, simply getting along with everyone and wanted to go home, you know, the same way that he came in. That essentially this person came armed, had a predisposition to commit some sort of a crime, and then found that based on what seemed to be just a regular conflict that would take place among high school kids turned out to be a lethal event. And so they're going to try to make the case that the fact that the knife was present at the scene showed the type of individual that Mr. Anthony was or is.
There's so much talk just in the last couple of days about the fact of the jury makeup and how long it took to find a jury and how the attorney said, we're going to sift through these 600 people and get down to a jury of 12 and 6. So much conversation just about that and who the makeup of the jury itself.
Absolutely, David. And I think that, you know, based on previous studies that we've done for the past 20, 25 years, you know, and there's a general wide belief among lawyers that the makeup of the jury gives the best chances to either side. And so they're going to be spending a lot of time with people that study the behavior of a potential juror, being able to figure out certain socioeconomic patterns, racial patterns, as it relates to the likely outcome based on what the prosecutor is looking for versus what the defense attorneys are looking for. So, you know, there are theories out there. If you're a middle-aged person, you're Caucasian, you come from a certain background, you're more likely to be punitive than somebody that is not from such a background. And so I'm sure that those theories were being tested, but we will not know if they work or not until the very end of the trial.
Now, we did kind of get a glimpse of where the defense is going with this during their opening statement. Mike Howard, one of the two attorneys, referred to Carmelo Anthony as Mello, so we learned a nickname, how his family calls him. He talks about Mello was a son, a brother, and so on. How important is the defense strategy to relate to the jury, you know, about their client so they can relate to him as much as possible?
Absolutely. And so you want to say his name. You want to make sure you throw out there what nicknames he had. You want to talk about what things he likes to do in his off time, the type of GPA that he had, which I heard that, you know, that was brought up as well. And so the idea is to try to humanize, right, Mr. Anthony, to try to make him be like a real person, that is a guy that is just like an average person in our community that would never do anything or cause any harm to anyone. This is a good kid that happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time and felt that he needed to defend himself, and therefore he engaged in this particular act of violence.
One thing about this particular case, when it first happened and the police first made the arrest, was the fact that social media and GoFundMe pages are set up and people donated upwards of $600,000 to Mr. Anthony.
Yeah, David, I think that we live in times that are very interesting. You know, we've seen in other trials around the country that, you know, people have proposed marriage to individuals that are being suspected of killing others. And, you know, quite honestly, that's not a new phenomenon. But what is new is, in fact, these GoFundMe accounts where people are putting their money where their mouth is. And in addition to that, I think that there is a, sadly, for our country, we are divided politically. We are divided along many other lines. And these types of events, what they do is they lead people to be polarized, you know, make it into a white versus black issue or a black versus white issue, a Christian versus a non-Christian issue in some other instances. And it's really sad because I think what that does is it makes us kind of see things through a different lens, and not based on reality or based on facts, but based on political ideology.
Do you think it's possible the decision by the judge to ban cameras could backfire?
You know, I think the only way that it could backfire is if people begin to raise the issue of the First Amendment, right? The ability of having access to these trials, being able to show the audience what it is that's being presented in court. Look, everybody was glued to the TV when O.J. Simpson's trial was going on, right? And we've seen other trials that have been carried out. And everybody makes up their mind as to what's going on in the trial at the time and whether or not the prosecutor screwed up or the defense attorney screwed up. So I think that there is a little bit less drama in that regard. There's also the risk that the public is going to have a perception that is not even close to reality as to what's actually happening inside that courtroom. But on the other hand, there's a safety protocol. And I think that the judge did what the judge had to do in order to be able to safeguard the lives of the individuals that not only attend the court, but also those that work in the court setting. And look, we already had someone get arrested recently that came in as an individual trying to promote the idea that this is a racial issue. And so we're going to see other actors try to do the same. And I think that there is that word of caution as it relates to safety that we always have to adhere to.
What's life like for the jury right now in having to start listening to this case and go through this and make this final decision?
It's a huge responsibility because even though you don't have the death penalty at stake, what you do have is up to 99 years of imprisonment, right? For a young person whose life is just starting. And then the victim whose life ended, right? So, I mean, so you have to sort of weigh both of those factors. And on the one hand, you've got the burden of responsibility of saying, you know, beyond a reasonable proof, you know, what in fact happened here? Was this person really guilty of killing someone intentionally and understanding fully well what he was doing with this knife? And then, you know, what was taken away from this family, regardless of what happens to Mr. Anthony, whether he is, in fact, found not guilty or perhaps he's found guilty and given the most severe sentence. Regardless of that, the young man that died as a result of this will never come back, and that family will forever be affected by it. And I think that people are sensitive to that, and the jurors carry that huge responsibility that in the end, they're going to be criticized by one side or the other.
Anytime you have a high-profile case that's getting national, and in this case, I believe, international attention, what does it do long-term effects to that community long after the trial is over?
Well, so everyone, first of all, everyone that watched the incident, right, is scarred for life. You also have the school now. You have school officials. You have people that are responsible for securing the premises. You've got the local police department involved. I mean, it leaves a lot of scar tissue for years to come. And it leaves a trauma to that community. People move out of those neighborhoods as a result of it. And we don't know what we don't know about what the aftermath of the verdict is going to bring, right? We have no idea if this is going to be done in the midst of the World Cup taking place in the Metroplex, or if this is going to take place at the same time we got other world events going on. And what is it going to do to community resources? What is it going to do to pose safety issues, you know, to these worldwide events that are taking place in the Metroplex? So I think it really is although fascinating, it is also a tormenting moment for people whose lives are to secure the lives of other people.
Thank you so much for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo and KRLD 1080 in Dallas. You can find these programs on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts. You can find these True Crime Roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.